Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, your 22 minutes of science news and music from Austin, Texas. I'm Michael Brennan. This week, we explore snowball Earth theory. We'll talk about this week's penumbral eclipse and Song of the Week by the Heartless Bastards. Here's your scientist soundbite.
There are these times when it looks like the entire world, or Earth, was either completely covered in ice or mostly covered in ice. And so these are interesting periods to study because with all the extrasolar planets being discovered now, we want to try to understand what makes a planet capable of having life for long periods of time.
That's geophysical scientist Dorian Abbott. We'll speak with him later, but first, Emily Howard is here to run through science news of the week.
A new study led by Florida State University evolutionary anthropologist Dean Falk has revealed that portions of the brain of Albert Einstein are unlike those of most people. The differences could relate to Einstein's unique discoveries about the nature of space and time. Falk's team used photographs of Einstein's brain taken shortly after his death, but not previously analyzed in detail. The photographs showed that Einstein's brain had an unusually complex pattern of convolutions in the prefrontal cortex, which is important for abstract thinking.
Although October 2012 was below average in temperature across the contiguous United States, the latest report by the National Climatic Data Center shows October 2012 tied with 2008 as the fifth warmest October recorded globally since record-keeping began in 1880.
Rice University scientists have unveiled a revolutionary new technology that uses nanoparticles to convert solar energy directly into steam. The new solar steam method from Rice's Laboratory for Nanophotonics is so effective it can even produce steam from icy cold water. Details of the solar steam method were published this week in ACS Nano. The inventors of solar steam said they expect the first uses of the new technology will not be for electricity generation, but rather for sanitation and water purification in developing countries.
Researchers at the University of California, Santa Barbara, have designed a detector that uses nanotechnology to mimic the biological mechanism behind canine scent receptors. According to these researchers, dogs are still the gold standard for scent detection of explosives. But just like humans, dogs can have an off day. Portable, accurate, and highly sensitive devices that sniff out vapors from explosives and other harmful substances could become as commonplace as smoke detectors in public places. That's Science News of the Week. This week's Song of the Week is Gotta Have Rock and Roll by the Heartless Bastards.
We'll be right back.
listening to EarthSky 22. You can find us as EarthSky on Facebook, EarthSky Science on Twitter, and at EarthSky.org. Deborah Bird is here to talk about the upcoming penumbral eclipse and some planets that you can see this autumn. Welcome, Deborah.
Hi, Mike. Penumbral eclipse, that's a lunar eclipse, but it's not like the kind of lunar eclipse where you see sort of a bite taken out of the moon. It's not that obvious. A penumbral eclipse is a way more subtle kind of lunar eclipse. So what happens is that during any kind of lunar eclipse, the Earth's shadow falls on the moon. But Earth's shadow has two parts. It has kind of an outer, lighter penumbral shadow and an inner umbral shadow. So when you see a dark bite taken out of the moon, that's called an umbral lunar eclipse. That's the inner, darker part of Earth's shadow falling on the moon's face. But this isn't that. This is the outer, lighter part of the shadow falling on the moon's face. So, you know, depending on how observant you are, some people are like really, really observant and notice that shadow easily. And some people can be standing outside looking at the eclipse going like, where's the eclipse?
So when is this happening and what can we look for?
Well, North America can see this eclipse, and North America is going to see it on the morning of November 28th. I mean, luckily for us in the Northern Hemisphere right now, the nights are long. So that's going to mean a lot of people are going to see this eclipse. So the morning of November 28th for us in North America, for Eastern Europe, Eastern Africa, Asia, the Middle East, places like that, it's actually going to be after sunset on November 28th. So depending, you should come to earthsky.org and look at some of the charts and maps that we have to see exactly where you'll see the eclipse on your part of the globe.
Okay. Yeah, so what's it going to look like to people that can see it?
Well, so you're looking at a full moon because every eclipse takes place at full moon. So there's a bright full moon shining in the night sky. And what you'll begin to see is kind of a dusky shading on one side of the moon. And so this dusky shading on the moon's face will crawl across the moon's face, taking in more and more and more of that bright surface of the full moon. And then finally, at the greatest part of the eclipse, about 90% of the moon is going to be covered by this light penumbral shadow of the Earth. In fact, if the shadow kept going, the shadow, you'd get into the umbral, the darker umbral part of the shadow, and then you would see that little bite taken out of the moon. But in fact, that's not going to happen at all at this eclipse.
Sounds cool anyways.
Yeah, it's really cool. And it's even more cool, Mike, because the planet Jupiter, which is one of the brightest planets we see from Earth, the largest planet in our solar system, is going to be near the moon that night. So you're going to see this moon, this full moon, which is cool enough, and then you're going to see Jupiter next to it, and then you have this penumbral eclipse. And again, for North America, that's going to happen on the morning of November 28th. For Europe, Asia, it's going to happen after sunset on November 28th. And so, again, come to earthsky.org and look up the exact time in your location, because it does vary from place to place.
Wow, sounds like a great night for sky watching.
Right. And I want to tell you also before I go, Mike, about the planets in the pre-dawn sky, too.
Okay.
So Venus has been in the pre-dawn sky for some time, but there are a couple of other planets now that are showing up in the eastern sky before dawn. So if you're up early and you look toward the east and you have a good, clear, unobstructed view of the east, you'll definitely see the planet Venus because it's really, really bright. It's the brightest of the planets. It's even brighter than Jupiter, which is brighter than all the stars. So you know that, you know, Venus and Jupiter are the brightest planets. So you look toward the east, you see the planet Venus. And, you know, at that same time, by the way, Jupiter's going to be in the western sky. So they'll both be in the sky at the same time, which will also be really cool to see. But in the east, next to Jupiter, there's another planet. And that's a fainter planet, the planet Saturn. So Saturn is just now coming back into view. It was behind the sun as seen from Earth. And now it's coming back into view for its, you know, another season of visibility. And it's in the eastern sky next to Venus by the end of November. Very cool thing to see. And even the planet Mercury, which we sometimes call the most elusive planet, that's the planet that's closest to the sun in the solar system. So it stays near the sunrise or the sunset. And indeed, it's very near the sunrise right now. By late November, you'll be able to see that very bright planet Venus in the eastern sky before dawn. Jupiter will be in the western sky before dawn at that time. The planet Saturn will be right next to Venus in the east. And the little planet Mercury will be just coming coming out of the, just low on the horizon, just coming out of the dawn, right before sunrise. So that'll be very interesting to see.
Yeah, a bunch of planets to see and a penumbral eclipse. That sounds great.
It's a good time to look at the sky.
All right, thanks a lot, Deborah.
Thank you, Mike.
Earth Sky's Deborah Bird, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Snowball Earth is a theory suggesting that more than 650 million years ago, for up to millions of years at a time, Earth was entirely smothered in ice. There is geologic evidence suggesting this happened, but scientists have not been able to agree on how a highly reflective, ice-covered Earth could ever have thawed out. On November 13th, the American Geophysical Union announced a study casting some new light on this theory. Scientists studied the heat-trapping potential of clouds above an ice-covered world, which they now say could help explain how Snowball Earth thawed. Dorian Abbott at the University of Chicago led the study. Dorian, welcome to Earth Sky.
Thanks.
So what is Snowball Earth?
So basically, about 630 million years ago and about 715 million years ago and maybe about 2.2 billion years ago, there are these times when it looks like the entire world, or Earth, was either completely covered in ice or mostly covered in ice. And so these are interesting periods to study because, in particular, with all the extrasolar planets being discovered now, we want to try to understand what makes a planet capable of having life for long periods of time, for billions of years. And these are examples where Earth, for 4 billion years, was a very happy place for life. And then all of a sudden, in these two or three times, you crashed into a near catastrophe that could have snuffed out life, potentially. And so it's a very important problem just for understanding perspective on the evolution and survival of life.
What's the evidence for a snowball Earth?
So the main evidence is geologists can look in the geological record, and there are certain things that are very good signs for glaciation. And in particular, if you have little stones, and even big stones, meter-sized stones, that are dropped all over the place into a sediment that was formed in a shallow sea, this is a strong sign that glaciers were flowing into that sea. Also, if you look at the rocks from adjacent to those seas, if you look at rocks that would have been on land, they're scratched up, and only glaciers do that. There are strong geological evidences of glaciation all through Earth's history. What's unique about these snowball periods is that paleomagnetic evidence suggests that the glaciations reached all the way to the equator. So that's the strongest evidence. The second evidence is that the snowball Earth hypothesis involves Earth getting covered with ice that reflects a lot of sunlight, and so it gets really cold, and then you eventually melt out, and the ice gets replaced with ocean, with Earth like today, and all of a sudden you're absorbing all the sunlight by the ocean rather than reflecting it with ice, and the CO2 is really high, and so it's extremely hot. So the snowball Earth theory predicts this bistability and hysteresis in global climate, where you go from extremely cold to extremely hot conditions. And so the second main piece of evidence is that on top of all these low-latitude equatorial glacier geology, there are carbonate sequences which only form in the hottest possible climates. And so the geology suggests that you jumped from extremely cold to extremely hot, which is consistent with the snowball idea.
Can you explain in a few sentences how clouds might have helped a snowball Earth begin to thaw?
Yeah, the problem is that the first serious big climate models used to test this, it's one in particular, the first model used to test this, when they increased the CO2 to huge values, it didn't make the model get out of a snowball Earth. And so there are independent geochemical proxies that tell you what the CO2 may have gotten to, and you were nowhere near escaping from a snowball Earth at the high values that that these proxies suggest. And so that sort of created a potential problem for the snowball Earth, because we're not in a snowball Earth today, so there has to be a way to get out of it if it ever happened. Otherwise, it didn't happen. And so this is where the clouds come in. And basically, clouds can cool the planet by reflecting sunlight, but they can also warm the planet by trapping heat that's emitted by Earth, infrared radiation to space. So they can make a blanket, which we call the greenhouse effect. And some greenhouse is good. If we didn't have the greenhouse effect, we'd be in a snowball now. But, you know, we don't want too much extra greenhouse effect, which is the global warming issue. But the idea is, if you're in a snowball Earth, then the clouds will have very little effect reflecting sunlight, but they can still provide warming. And so they could be potentially a big warming effect on a snowball Earth. And we redid these calculations with six different global climate models, including models, one that has extremely sophisticated cloud scheme, and basically many of the models, three of them are being used to forecast future climate, so they're very sophisticated climate models, and we found that in five of them, there was a significant cloud warming, and it was sufficient that when you increase the CO2, you did escape from the snowball Earth. So you still have to increase the CO2. Clouds don't get you out alone. But before, you couldn't get out at all, and now you can. And the one model that didn't produce clouds happened to be the model that was the first one used, which suggested that this could be a problem. And so what this work suggests is that potential snowball killer, or argument against the snowball, probably doesn't hold weight. So you probably can get out of the snowball with a traditional mechanism. So it doesn't settle the dispute about whether a snowball Earth happened, but it removes this theoretical constraint. The snowball Earth is totally different. It's a climate so cold that at the equator, at Ecuador, you know, Cuba was covered in miles of ice. It's a crazy climate. The one caveat is that we don't have a complete understanding of why Earth went into a snowball Earth, mm-hmm. but it's very unlikely we're going to go into another snowball Earth on any sort of humanly relevant timescale. The sun is becoming more luminous. Mm-hmm. So the sun emits 1% more energy every 100 million years. So 600 million years ago, the sun was 6% weaker, which means it was much easier to get into a snowball Earth. And so as the eons go by, it gets harder and harder to get into a snowball Earth.
Okay.
And the question of whether Earth will end in ice or fire, in terms of climate theory, has been settled. It's going to end in fire. So in 1 or 2 billion years, we're going to turn into Venus. But we won't. It's very unlikely we'll experience another snowball Earth in the next billion years. Earth is through that part of its history, probably.
What's the takeaway here? What do you want our listeners to know about snowball Earth theory?
The main reason it's interesting is because we want to understand the history of Earth, and the basic focus of a lot of research in these areas is Earth special? Is there something strange about Earth, or should planets like Earth tend to have life evolve on them and reach some high level of complexity? And that's a question that's becoming increasingly pertinent with all sorts of recent exoplanet discoveries, for example, by the Kepler mission, the NASA Kepler mission. So so we want to know if things like snowball Earth are important for development of complex life, and if they are common, aside from just understanding Earth history. And my research is important because there's debate about whether a snowball Earth happened. It's a hypothesis that is accepted by some and rejected by others, and it hasn't been proven yet. One of the arguments that was used against the snowball Earth was that you couldn't escape from it because the CO2 wasn't... When you increase the CO2, you still didn't get out of the snowball Earth. And the reason that this work is important is because we remove that argument as an objection. So, you know, we show that you can escape from a snowball Earth.
That was geophysical scientist Dorian Abbott. And that's our show. Thanks for joining us. This week's show was recorded in Earth Sky Studio B in Austin, Texas, the live music capital of the world. Special thanks to our musical contributors. For more information about the music or the science you heard, please visit earthsky.org. Thanks for listening. Till next week, be good to one another. I'm Michael Brennan. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many. stage.